From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the spirit world. Here's what's happening. President Biden addressed the nation today, saying he stands squarely behind his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan after having a presence for 20 years, while admitting that the fall of the country to the Taliban did unfold more quickly than we had anticipated. The president, speaking from the White House, said his administration has been closely monitoring the situation on the ground in Afghanistan and is moving quickly to execute new plans to put in place, whatever they may be. He said, "I stand squarely behind my decision." Biden placed blame on the Afghan leadership for the country's plight, saying that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani had refused advice to negotiate and erroneously insisted Afghan forces would fight. And then a horror today at the Kabul airport. At least seven individuals have been killed in the chaos at Kabul's international airport as thousands of Afghans desperately attempted to flee the Taliban's capture of their country. Video circulating on social media show hundreds of Afghans running across the tarmac as U.S. troops fired warning shots in the air. One showed a crowd pushing and shoving its way up a staircase trying to board a plane, with some other people hanging off the railings. Another shows several individuals plunging to their deaths hundreds of feet in the air after attempting to cling onto a U.S. Air Force C-17 transport plane as it took off. Chaos, totally. My God. And a tropical storm system threatening to unleash flash flooding and mudslides on the area of Haiti, where a 7.2 magnitude earthquake killed almost 1,300 people on Saturday. Horrible situation there. A little California boy dies after contracting brain-eating amoebas while swimming in a pond. My gosh. A new study out of Yale University suggests the reason that your Facebook and Twitter feeds are now laden with scathing political diatribes and lengthy personal commentary is because we've been trained to post those through a system of rewards powered by likes and shares. Simply put, because content with expressions of moral outrage is more popular as we publish more of it. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our friend from the Internet. Lauren, strange story, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, this study seems a bit confusing. On one hand, it appears to be blaming users for posting more and more extreme, outraged posts. And on the other hand, it seems to be blaming social media algorithms. I guess it's trying to blame both. But I think the push in many quarters to usually blame the algorithms first may be a bit simplistic. And along the same lines, the study's discussion of the effects of more moderate versus more extreme social media feedback seems somewhat simplistic as well. We know that it's human nature to pay more attention to the unusual and extreme rather than the mundane. What gets all the attention on the freeway? The guy on the side with a boiled over radiator or the five-car pileup accident? Again, yeah. It's just human nature. And we also know that there was plenty of often dangerous misinformation and extreme misinformation floating around the net even before Facebook mattered. Do you remember all those creepy email chain letters with the long, long CC lists that people would send pushing various conspiracy theories and urging you to forward it along as email to 10 more people? No algorithms involved, no algorithms required other than those running in human brains. The bottom line here, I think, is that we should be very careful about making generalizations in these areas. There are a whole lot of different factors and motivations involved, and while the technology of the moment certainly plays major roles, it seems reasonably likely that we might be observing fairly similar patterns now, even if no social media algorithms were involved at all. Research in these areas is always good to see. We'll be learning more as all manner of related research continues going forward. So we will just see what happens.
Good job, Lauren. Keep it up for us.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
Tony Bennett has said goodbye to where he is most happy, the stage. Following his back-to-back shows alongside Lady Gaga at Radio City Music Hall, the 95-year-old music legend will not be returning to the stage for live performances on the advice of his doctor's orders. He's still going to sing, but he's just not going to do live shows anymore. And for 95, I'm amazed that he has continued to perform the way he has. You know, he said that it's exhausting, and his doctor is advising him not to do live shows, so he's not going to do them anymore. Tony Bennett, 95 years old, but keep going, Tony, keep going. Tucker Carlson to reveal some compelling UFO evidence on Thursday from Pentagon reports and a new Fox Nation report. He basically says pilots are seeing things every day, and there could be a danger to all of us from UFOs, so that'll be interesting. What else is going on in the skies these days? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Stephen, what do you got for us?
Hi there, George. We begin with space, as there's always a lot of information there. SpaceX's first private astronaut mission will be known as Inspiration 4. SpaceX has some additional ambitious plans for space exploration, as always, so get set for the first private astronaut mission, as I mentioned before, known as Inspiration 4. There'll be four private sector astronauts, which are set to launch to space on or about September the 15th on a Crew Dragon capsule. But all this, George, is then financed by New Jersey billionaire Jared Isaacson. This will be the first crewed spacecraft and space flight to orbit around the Earth without professional astronauts on board. This is interesting. The purpose of the space flight is to create awareness and support for St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital and do some space research, too, while they orbit the Earth. One of the crew members who's on board is a bone cancer survivor and a physician's assistant at St. Jude's. And the crew expects George to orbit the Earth for 3 days, launching on a SpaceX Falcon 9 booster. Moving rapidly to astronomy, Jupiter is the planet of the week, and we'll talk more about that in the live sky, George. It's some of the most powerful auroras in the entire solar system Jupiter has, so powerful that its magnetic field is 20,000 times that of the Earth's. And one source of Jupiter's magnetic field in auroras is thought by scientists to be material streaming off Jupiter's moon Io, which, by the way, can be seen pretty easily in backyard telescopes. Moving on to Saturn, recent discoveries regarding Saturn show evidence of a ripple in Saturn's inner rings caused by the core of Saturn being a not small solid, as many thought, but rather a large soup of rock and ice extending out to about 60% of the planet or the ball of the planet, causing these gravity ripples in the rings. We always end off with the live sky. The moon now moves on to its gibbous or egg-shaped phase, and a few Perseid meteors are still lurking out there, so keep your eyes peeled. The moon then returns to full on August the 22nd at 8:02 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and this will be known as the full Sturgeon Moon. The moon is closest to us, George, on the 17th at its perigee position, and this is the week, as I mentioned before, talking about Jupiter. It comes to opposition on August the 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, when Jupiter will be very close to us, astronomically speaking, 373 million miles from the Earth, and spectacular in small telescopes. And to locate the positions of the four main moons, many people are asking me about this, simply go to shallowsky.com. You'll see the layout of the moons. Some wonder, how much mass would Jupiter need, George, to begin a fusion cycle like a star? Incredibly, it would need 80 times its current mass just to do that. More information, we always love, theskylive.com. Emails are great. We love them. Thank you. DrSkyShow@gmail.com. What do we say, George? Always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next Monday. Up next, John Zerzan back with us after 9 years. He's been in touch with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. He's written our latest book, When We Are Human, Notes from the Age of Pandemics. But wait till you hear what he has to say next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our guest, John Zerzan. He's an American anarchist. We'll tell you about that and what that means, and philosopher and author. His latest book is When We Are Human. His works criticize agricultural civilization as inherently oppressive, and advocates drawing upon the ways of life of hunter-gatherers as an inspiration for what a free society should look like. Some subjects of his criticism include domestication, language, symbolic thought, such as mathematics and art, and the concept of time as well. And he's been in touch with the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. We'll talk about that, too. John, welcome back to the program. It's been 9 years since you were on our show.
I was trying to remember. My guess was 7, but I guess it's been 9.
And 9 years. How have you been? Everything okay?
Yeah, things are fine.
Great. John, give us a definition, first of all, to what an anarchist is.
Well, you can look at that, it seems to me, in two different ways. Traditionally, it goes back to the 19th century, we might call it red anarchism or leftist anarchism, and it went along with a lot of the mainstream developments in the same way that Marx did. In other words, industrialism, the Industrial Revolution, all fine, you know, no problem. But more recently, I think something much better has come along, namely green anarchy or anarcho-primitivism, primal anarchy, several names, but it's the same deal. And it diverts from the old classical anarchism and really indicts industrialism itself and mass society and a whole number of things, including civilization, to actually discover deeper roots to the crisis we're in now.
Did you grow into this, John, or were you always this way?
Oh, it was a long road at my age. I mean, I'm really a child of the 60s, and I was a labor organizer at first, and I was very interested in unionism.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the critique of unionism, unions as a disciplinary force in England. The first unions were in England in the textile industry. And all of that kind of led from one thing to another over the years. You take up one thread and it leads to something else. And in other words, what is the function of the factory system itself? I mean, Marx thought it was wonderful. It was going to unite the proletariat. You herd all the people into the factories, and then you get this powerful radical force. Well, that was totally wrong, absolutely. It really just domesticates people further and lessens the chance of any kind of radical movements.
John, if you were writing for Hollywood during the Hollywood blacklisting time, would they have gotten you because of your views?
Oh, they probably would have thought it was so odd and unrelated to things that I probably wouldn't have been bothered by
now,
the authorities.
Now, an anarchist also doesn't like technology, right?
Right.
And because of one thing, a lot of people who are anarchists believe that they take away jobs from, you know, the working class, and unfortunately that's correct, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But it's a lot more, you know, as we've been able to see as things roll along. I mean, these claims, you know, really, and in a way it's taken over from political ideology, the various claims and promises about the future, what we can have, where we're going, and so forth. And they turn out to be basically very false. For example, it connects us. Modern technology connects. We've never been so disconnected. It's just completely wrong. I mean, if you go down the list, has it empowered people? No, I think we're less empowered than before all the technology, as subjects, you know, as actors in the world. So all these general claims, and look what it's doing. I mean, it's based on systematically ravaging the natural world. That's where it all comes from. These shiny phones and everything else. You got to have the mining. You got to have the smelting. You got to have, you know, you got to exploit nature, and you got to keep going.
I told my senior producer, Tom Danheiser, that we were trying to get a hold of you. I wanted to talk to you a little bit earlier, but I said, call his cell. And he said, I don't think he has one. You don't, do you?
No, I don't. I don't do social media. I mean, I have a radio show. I mean, I'm plugged in like everybody else in so many ways, but
yeah.
Certain things I try to avoid.
Your new book is called When We Are Human. Tell me about that title.
Oh, it's kind of a general title. You know, all of my books are collections of essays. I mean, there's everything in there from one on about fire to the enclosure movement in England and love. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to think of a title that would kind of wrap it all together. But at the same time, the question, when we're human, is a question at large, it seems to me. How much humanness are we allotted? Are we very human or less human? I mean, I think it's kind of scary that we would even ask the question. And I go back to what Alan Turing, this always occurs to me. You know, Alan Turing, the code breaker in World War II.
Right, right.
You know, and then he sort of a pioneer of the modern computer. Well, he wrote in 1950, almost 75 years ago, philosophy piece that he wrote, and I'll just paraphrase. He said, the future won't be so much when technology becomes more and more human and puts that across, but humans will become more and more like the technology. And he was way ahead of his time on that. I'm afraid that's the way it's worked out.
How do you feel the way the civilization is going right now, John? You think we're headed in the right direction? Do you think we're in trouble? What's your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think we're virtually in the end game stage of the thing. When you see all these crises, which seem to be morphing together, and they're coming on faster and more strongly. I mean, you look at the COVID and, you know, all these epidemics turning into pandemics, one after another. You know, there was H1N1, West Nile, SARS, not to mention the ones overseas, Zika, Ebola, so on and so on. Now this is a plague. That's the better word, pandemic. I think it's kind of euphemistic. But that's just part of it. I mean, look at the physical environment. Look at what's going on with, with the heat waves.
Oh, the fires and things like that. It's crazy.
Dreadful.
Well, and just when I thought COVID was going away, this Delta variant pops up all of a sudden.
Right. Very scary.
And I just hope we can get through that. But it's doing something to our psyche, the way they're manipulating things and forcing things. I'm in St. Louis right now, and I had a chance to talk to a lot of people today about, masks or not and things like that. And they're getting really tired of what's happening. And I don't know how long people can take it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see what's happening on airplanes right now. People are unruly more than they've ever been before. Mm-hmm. And I cite the pandemic for things like that and control, and people are just getting uptight. They're losing it. That could get worse. You know that?
Oh, I think so. The stress on everybody makes everything more difficult. I mean, it's just a fact. And even before the pandemic, of course, we had road rage and so forth before.
Sure.
These fights.
But not like we've have now. Wow.
Oh, no, that's right. It's just... And so much else. I mean, all these articles, endless stuff about anxiety and depression, suicide rates among the kids, and the opioid crisis. It just is a very sad landscape, and it's the psyche, very tattered. We're just not in good shape. It's not going in a very good direction. What is the healthy thing you can point to? I mean, can you find one, really? I mean, I'd hate to be so pessimistic, but it doesn't look good.
The best part about it is we're still alive. You are, I am, my family, and the people we care about. That's important.
Yes. Let's not forget that.
Thank God.
We're still trying to do something.
Is there any kind of technology that you welcome?
Well, the short answer is no. I'm afraid. Yeah, I'm a pretty hardcore Luddite. I think that these things are not really promised. They're not making good on the promises. In other words, one thing you could see in terms of maybe deconstructing how much is being said or how much we're being sold, it'll cure things. It'll heal us. It'll make the future so wonderful. But when you look at it, and this is a big generalization, but I think when you look at it, it's the technology in a general sense that has caused every problem that it claims to come around and solve. That's kind of uncanny, but I think it's largely true. Like cancer, I mean, when did that start? Or there are many examples, I would say, and it's just kind of a con game. It just doesn't make things better. It's you have wonderful cars, and then you have congestion, pollution, and traffic jam. I mean, where does that, how does that get us any further? You can walk somewhere faster in so many cities, and of course the world is more and more urbanized by the hour. So all of this, in fact, that's pretty much at the heart of why the population thing is out of control. If I can go off on a tangent for just a second on that. I mean, you know, people say, well, you can't be a Luddite or critique civilization. There's 7 billion people to feed. Well, why are there 7 billion? Soon it'll be 50 billion. You know, when we started the Industrial Revolution...
Hold on for a second, John. We're at the break, but we'll come back. We'll talk more about that. We'll talk more about your book, When We Were Human. And I've got to ask you about the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with John Zerzan. John does have his website, which we have linked up at coasttocoastam.com. That may be the only technology you do, John, huh?
Well, you know, my weekly radio show streams, so it's, you know, it's got to be high tech. In fact, to call it radio these days, I mean, the radio signal, I mean, that's kind of old-fashioned already, you know what I mean? It's everything gets more high tech. But I can't, I don't want to just sit somewhere with my thumb in my mouth. I mean, people can say, well, what a hypocrite. You use the technology. Well, you have to. I mean, what choice is there?
Sure.
I'm trying to contribute something and with my writing and so forth. And, you know, this is the world we have. It's not the world I wanted, but here we are.
You were talking about the world's population, 7 billion people. It's going to continue to go. It's going to go to 9 billion. I mean, how do we stop it without being genocidal?
Well, that's the primary challenge for those of us who are anarcho-primitivists who want to go back, if you will, to reverse this trend somehow. Yeah, it would require a transition of a kind of unimaginable scale if you really took that on. Otherwise, you just go with the tide. I mean, what choice is there except to try to resist that if you see where it takes us? I mean, Noam Chomsky, famous leftist public intellectual, he's attacked us. We're genocidists because not only genocidal in thinking, but active genocidists, according to him. We want all these people to die. Well, that's really not, it's kind of silly to say that. Of course, we do not.
That's not true. No.
Yeah, you know, and nobody's saying if you could pull a switch, just do it, and then you erase all these people. Well, no, that's crazy. That's not at all what we're talking about. He has to answer the question of why are there so many people? What accounts for the unnatural, I would say unnatural, population rise? Because for a million or 2 years, Homo species, it was very stable at a very low level of numbers. So then it shoots up, especially when you get to the Industrial Revolution, it goes crazy. And it's still going crazy because the world has to industrialize. Every country has to be, you know, in the running. And, you know, the whole thing works together. It's an integrated machine, if you will, and it's killing everything.
Now, a guy who took it too far back in 1978 to 95 was Ted Kaczynski. His Unabombing killed 3 people, injured 23. He was opposed to industrialization. He was somewhat of an anarchist as well. You had a chance. You communicated with him, or did you talk with him? Tell us about that.
Well, I visited him. In fact, I think I was the only visitor when he was on trial. When he was held in Sacramento between from 96 to 98.
And he's 79 now, right now, I think.
Yeah, he's a little bit older than me, even. Yeah. Well, I was able to visit accompanied by parts of the legal team. We never did have a chance to speak very freely, but I visited him 3 or 4 times. I was there on the last day when the sentence was decided, when the case was closed.
Did you ever visit him in prison?
Yeah, this was in prison.
In prison, okay.
County jail.
Okay.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't paranoid schizophrenic. That's kind of, I would say he's slightly autistic.
Did he have any remorse?
I don't think so. I don't think he has. That's the separation we have. I certainly don't advocate sending bombs in the mail to people, but that was not our conversation. The conversation was strictly about ideas about technology.
Well, what made you contact him?
Well, I began to realize, especially when he forced the Washington Post and the New York Times to publish his so-called manifesto,
right,
Industrial Society and Its Future, that And I was really holding off. I didn't read that for a while. And a friend said, you got to read it. It's great. And it is. I think it's, I have no, I really recommend that. I think it's marvelous. And
what?
He argues two things. He argues that the more society becomes a technological society, the less meaning there is for the individual. And the other part is the less freedom for the individual. And the, and he goes on to try to make that case. And it's very sensible. I mean, it's not, you know, incendiary. In fact, to call it a manifesto is really not very accurate. So that part of it, we had lots of conversations about that. I had not been in contact with him before he was arrested. I didn't know anything. I never heard of him.
Why did he have to kill people, maim people, John, to get his point across?
Well, I guess he was just frustrated. He would he wrote this manifesto, so-called, as early as the 70s, and he was trying to get it published, but he'd given up on being a professor. He was a brilliant mathematician at the University of California, the best math faculty in the world, perhaps. You know, he's a genius. But he renounced all that to go live in a cave, and so when he'd show up with this manifesto, and I hate to keep using that term, but anyway, and they'd ask him, where is the a professor at? And he'd say, oh, I'm not a professor. And they'd show him the door. That's the way it is. You know, you don't write theoretical stuff unless you're part of the professoriate, I guess. A little different in Europe. But anyway, I'm not saying that's the real good excuse to kill people. Not saying that at all. But I think, and as he said, you know, it was encroaching on him more and more. In western Montana, near Lincoln, Montana, he thought he could just live it out in his little one-room shack and, you know, hike around in the forests and so on. Well, then the planes started coming over, the motorcycle characters were roaring past. You know, it's just, there's no place to hide, ultimately.
Right. And his brother turned him in, right?
Yeah, his brother David ratted him out, yep. They probably would have never found him without.
Well, that's a good point. When you were with him, how did you feel? I mean, did you feel like he's going to attack me at any moment or something? I mean, I would have felt that way if I was interviewing Charlie Manson, for example.
Yeah, more Manson, I think. No, he was kind of a slight fellow, kind of a formal fellow in the way he talked. Nothing very unusual. He was a prisoner, and they kind of pushed him around a little bit. They couldn't push him around a lot because the whole world media was watching that case.
When's the last time you saw him?
Early 98, on the day he was sentenced. I wasn't in court because I was on the outs with his lawyers by that time. But I visited him, and it was a strange visit because no more lawyers. I could just, it was all over. They didn't care what we were talking about then. And he said to me, I said, well, how'd it go in the courtroom? And, you know, I didn't know what else to say. But he said, well, it was the damnedest thing. All these people came in, and they emoted. They kind of cried and moaned and so forth. You know, I don't know why they did that. It was all decided already. They paraded these people in. And, you know, I just had this feeling there was something missing in terms of human feelings. If you kill somebody's relatives, they're probably going to be a little grief-stricken or whatever, right? So I didn't quite, I felt a little chill when he said that.
Would he commit to a tape radio interview?
No, I don't think so. He's very, very suspicious of the media.
With you and me?
I doubt it. He's refused that over the years.
He won't even go with you?
No. Well, we're not on very good terms anymore.
Oh, okay. Well, that explains
He's got a critique of technology, which I agree with, but I take it a little further, and he really was opposed to that.
Now, let's get back to this technology for a moment. And what makes you really and tell me the kind of technology you're opposed to so I can get an idea of this.
Well, you know, I think it goes way back to division of labor. Way back, you know, I'm talking about the Paleolithic, where it starts, and you start to somehow see a gradation of authority or power. Maybe the shamans were the first ones. And I'm not saying they were evil, but they exercised authority over others, and sometimes not in a very positive way. Anyway.
It's control.
Yeah, it starts to be that. And what it sets up is domestication. And earlier in the show, I heard somebody talking about control. And that's when you get to the technology takes you or sets the stage for that big shift, which is domestication, which is, or call it farming. Let's use the simple word agriculture. That's where, that's a big shift. Freud wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, and that's exactly what he was talking about. He said, we're not meant to be domesticated like horses or cattle or whatever, and it's a painful thing. And domestication involves everything, involves us.
Well, what's your opposition to farming?
Well, that's what it is, domestication. It's you don't have a free life of taking what nature gives. You control not only nature, but each other.
Is it because there's just too many of us? I mean, we can't all be hunter-gatherers.
Well, no, not foreseeably, but actually that was one of the things that was now in disrepair, the idea that, well, at a certain point, you have a number of people, then you got to start farming just to support those people. Well, it's better understood now in the literature as the increase of population didn't start until domestication was underway very largely. So it's not an effect, it's a cause. You know, one more negative cause, you know, and that almost instantly leads to civilization. Once you have domestication, you have, you know, Egypt, Mesopotamia, you have war, slavery, everything you can think of that hasn't worked out very well. And it all goes back to that. So the question I'm answering very abstractly in terms of the technology, but I would really like to undo that whole thing. And then when Freud said domestication is a machine for making people unhappy, neurosis, that's the definition of neurosis. You don't want to be domesticated, and yet we all are domesticated, and we're not very happy. So that was such a radical thing. And Freud, by the way, he said, well, I don't mean you can't have civilization. Of course, we have to have that.
Sure.
Well, he just showed you why it's a very, very bad idea. I mean, he kind of backed away. But
do we have a choice?
Well, I think we do. I think we have to strive to have a choice. To have an alternative, you know, to go in a different way, in de-domestication, rewilding, even decolonization. It's all that, some of that, you know, all fits together, it seems to me.
I was at the grocery store today, John, and I'm looking around the store, and you're looking at the meat counter and the produce section and all that, and I'm thinking to myself, knowing that you were going to be on tonight, that there's no way that the store would be full without high technology.
Right.
And so what do we do about that?
Well, and it's a global system. You people rely on everything being shipped all over the place. And, I have a big garden, but I'm certainly just as much a part of it as anyone else. So, yeah, I go to the store and get things. And it's hard to imagine, having some different way to do that, you know, a different way to communicate, a different way to feed ourselves even.
Could you be more of a libertarian than an anarchist?
Well, libertarian, I think that has part of it, you know, the emphasis on individual freedom. But, I think the general deal with libertarianism is it exists fully within capitalism. And I think that's just another thing, kind of an epiphenomenon which would have to go. It would not be a capitalist system if you went all the way back. And I mean, that's where private property comes from. You start farming, you fence it off. Hey, don't take that. I worked hard to produce that. Don't just come in here and pick my apples. You know, I mean, it sounds benign, but in so many ways, it's not benign. And then you have all the rest of it. Who controls the distribution of it and so forth. And then you have hierarchy and it takes off.
And in terms of technology that you are for or against, what about like the automobile? Where do you stand
no,
there?
No, I mean, we're paving the whole planet, and that's just a horrible idea. It's just...
Yeah, but how do we get from place to place? Not stagecoaches.
Well, I mean, indigenous people had paths in the where they lived. They didn't seem to have the same need to travel great distances. They weren't so dispersed. They had, you know, small-scale community, which was much more cogent or coherent than what we have. You know, this is about community, for example. Well, you got to have community. We can all agree. Who would disagree with the desire for community? Well, where did it go? There's neighborhoods. I mean, but community, mass society, which is, you know, a product of mass production, of industrialism, has kind of swallowed it up. What happened to it? You know, community? Are you kidding? We're so alienated and estranged from each other. I don't think that word even corresponds to anything anymore.
Interesting.
We're not much.
When we come back from the break, John, I want to ask you, if you had your druthers, how would you build the ideal society, and what would it be like? What would it look like? We're going to take calls with John Zerzan in a moment here on Coast to Coast, so get ready to make the call as we talk about society and what things could be like without high technology. So jump on board and let us know. And it's fascinating discussion, John, to be sure. I mean, do people argue with you a lot, or do they talk to you?
Well, both, you know, especially when, I mean, these are not respectable ideas. You don't get to see them on TV or anything too much, right?
So they're pretty dramatic, to be sure. Let's talk more about it when we come back, and we'll take calls.